7. Anne-Marie, you're ready. Good morning, Mr. Secretary.
Good morning.
I have just been summoned into the sanctum sanctorum of Ways and Means, and so I am going to regrettably have to excuse myself and ask Senator Morris to begin your testimony. I apologize, Mr. Secretary, but unfortunately I'm going to have to absent myself, and I think, Monica, you're going to start with some replacement pages, and I will be back expeditiously.
Wonderful. I certainly understand the importance of the inner sanctum.
I apologize.
Leaves the rest of us wondering, though, doesn't it?
That's where the heavy lifting occurs.
I guess.
Members of the subcommittee, if you brought your binders with you, there are several packets of replacement pages before you that the agency has submitted. The first one is the revised prioritization pages, so those go behind Appendix C. There's a new addition, Appendix D, which is performance measures, reformatted into a similar style that you're seeing from the other agencies. And then the third packet that you have is just some revisions to the Secretary's presentation materials that goes behind your red tab labeled Phase 1 presentation.
So I'm sorry, was Appendix D a replacement?
It's an addition, and I don't believe you have a tab for that.
Oh, I got you.
Just slide it in behind.
I got you.
We need to slow down for us to learn.
Yeah.
Sorry. I'll go over it again.
Okay. Behind?
These spreadsheets.
Okay, yeah. Behind
go
C.
Behind Appendix C, and they're
okay,
replacement
take out,
pages.
Take
yeah.
out everything
take
out
of there. Everything out of there.
Now, do you say C or D?
C.
C, that's what I think.
Sorry. I will try again to enunciate more clearly. C.
Okay.
The next set is the annual performance measure packet. You do not have this in there, so this is an addition, and there is not a tab, so just slide it in behind your worksheets there. And the final piece is the Secretary's presentation, copy of the PowerPoint. And that goes behind your red tab. It's called Bill Bradbury Phase 1 Presentation. Look at the back.
That is a replacement.
And this is
and
a,
that's
replacement.
A replacement.
So just pull everything out just behind that tab and shove these in.
Done.
I'm going to show you the paper. Okay.
And I think with that, you're now prepared to take testimony.
Okay, good. Do you have any other comments?
I don't believe so. No.
Mr. Secretary?
Well, thank you very much, Senator Morris and members of the subcommittee. For the record, Bill Bradbury, Oregon Secretary of State. And I'm joined today by Jeff Morgan of our Business Services Division and Patty McGuire, who is my Deputy Secretary of State. And between the three of us, we're going to give it our best shot here. Basically, I just want to spend a few minutes giving you an overview of the agency. I'm going to talk about agency organization and major function, and then we're going to talk about some of the ways that we maximize our performance and efficiency, and then obviously at the end we'll talk about some of the major budget issues that are facing this agency. So if you start by looking at the Secretary of State's agency, what this agency is really all about is integrity. Certainly.
Are you under agency overview or under your
Phase 1 presentation.
Oh. I think you just put it in your book.
Right. But we had the first tab was agency overview. And but you're not referring to that. You're
no, I'm walking through a PowerPoint presentation that starts with a...
As I stated earlier, we have slow learners.
I appreciate it.
So you're going to start at the end and go backwards, right?
Start at the end and
this
do
is
go
the last part of the thing. And then when you're through here, we can go home. Right?
The Secretary is thinking, I wish I was testifying at the Washington legislature again.
Yeah.
We were up there yesterday. Side point, we were up there yesterday talking about vote by mail because Washington is moving. Which is great. So really, in our efforts to develop a mission for the agency, what it's all about is integrity, accountability, and information. and providing the public with information ties all of our diverse divisions together. And by providing public information, we do ensure the integrity and the accountability of state government. So it actually has helped us really think about our agency in a much more effective way. So if you talk about the mission of the Secretary of State's office, it's to provide the stewardship of public resources by, one, facilitating access to public records, two, ensuring that public dollars are well spent, three, offering registration services to businesses and consumers, four, safeguarding the democratic process through the Elections Division, and fifth is overseeing state lands for the Common School Fund. Those are the basic missions. Now, you look at how the agency is organized, we've got the four program divisions, Archives, Audits, Corporations, and Elections, and then the Executive Office overseeing it. And then we've got some support divisions, Business Services, Human Resources, and Information Systems. And basically, the role of the Executive Office is obviously to provide policy direction and oversight for our four very important program divisions and our three internal support divisions as well. And I want to give you a brief description of each of our program divisions. And so I want to start with archives. Obviously, what archives does is keep the records of governors, keeps the records of the legislature and all of your committee meetings, and it keeps the records of state agencies. And the other thing that's so interesting about archives is they provide a complete online access to Oregon's history. So there's a lot that people can get from archives beyond just records of government action. Second division, the audits division. Make sure that public money is spent effectively and efficiently. And in the last biennium, the audits division identified over $25 million in potential cost savings. Another division, the corporations division, and that's where businesses start in the state of Oregon. And it's in the process of creating a one-stop shop for business registration requirements with the new central business registry. And that's a very exciting project that I talk a lot about because I used to run a business on the South Coast, and I was always mystified by why I had to fill out all these different forms for all these agencies that I'd swear were in the same town in Salem. So we're on the track to create a one-stop business registry site. And then all of you know, except for perhaps Monica, all of you know the elections division because you've all been working with them. Obviously, the elections division oversees the administration of elections with 36 county clerks, and they provide information about elections to candidates, to committees, and to the public.
May I just ask you, and I will get to this later, but I'm going to be interested in funding for the voters pamphlet and where we're going with that.
Okay.
And possible sources of new funding.
Yes. Okay. Great. We have bills related to that.
Good.
And then the other thing is that those four public service divisions depend on the internal support divisions. We depend on business services to manage the money. We depend on human resources to manage the people, and we depend on information systems to manage the technology and keep things working effectively. So that's sort of just a real quick overview of the agency. What I'd like to do now is take a look at some of the ways that we've improved our performance and our efficiency. And let me start with organization changes that have been...
Question. Yeah, okay. Are we going to talk about state lands oversight somewhere else?
We certainly could. I serve as one of three members of the state land board.
Okay. My question is, and I raised it several times, including this morning at an earlier meeting with the president and the Ways and Means people. The land under the 3 mile limit, the land between within the 3 mile limit, we don't seem to be capturing any revenue from the resources on that land, and I'm wondering why. Or maybe we are. There must be a reason if we're not.
Yes, we do capture some resources.
Do you want me to talk about this?
Yeah, go for it.
For the record, Patty McGuire, Deputy Secretary of State. The Department of State Lands has been quite active in pursuing revenue from operators who want to bury fiber cables.
Well, okay.
I mean, it's an interesting day. I think this is a pretty great success story.
Well, let me jump ahead then, okay. Because that's the answer that I always get. I commercial fished off of Winchester in the 1980s, and that was when the ships came from the East Coast to scoop up all of our scallops out there.
Right.
And all the scallops, and also there's crabbing. It's a very rich area. And I know that we have grazing leases and so on and so forth, but do we not capture any revenue from the resources on our state lands
within the 3 miles? The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife does collect a fee from various harvesters of seafood resources. They pay a fee based on poundage. It doesn't come to state lands just because that's the way the government's been set up.
Okay, so we do then capture. Now, the Boston harvest ship that came and scraped the ocean floor, it'll take 50 years to recover. They paid a fee to do that?
It paid if it was harvesting seafood that's subject to Oregon
within the 3 mile limit.
Fees,
okay.
It would pay.
Well, I guess I want to pursue this at some point because I'm just kind of curious of whether or not the fees that are collected by the fish are adequate fees and whether or not this is a state land source of revenue that would go into the common school fund and so on. So
I can assure you that the fees collected by Fish and Wildlife do not go into the common school fund.
Well, I didn't think so.
Senator, what you're really talking about is the difference between a fee for regulation and enforcement of regulations and a fee for royalty by virtue of harvest of a resource.
Yeah.
And the latter does not exist, I would gather.
Okay. No, latter does not exist for seafood resources because a lot of this, well, we can get into it.
Okay.
Well, the seafood moves obviously inside and outside of 3 miles, and it's not, most of it's not on the bottom, which is
what we own. But
it's in the water column, which is
the crab are on the bottom.
The crab are on the bottom.
Yeah, and other crustaceans that we scrape up off the bottom are there. Okay. Any information you have about that, I'd appreciate.
I'd love to discuss this with you because I have lots of, I mean, having come from a coastal district, I obviously have a lot of, you know, interest and concern about seafood resources. Okay.
And then there's another issue of oil, natural gas exploration and so on, I understand, in some of those areas. So. Okay, good. Thank you.
I want to talk for a minute about ways that we've improved our performance and our efficiency. And let's start with the organization changes that we've made over the past 10 years. Basically, we're constantly examining our programs to make sure that we're operating as efficiently as possible. And over the past decade, we've made numerous staff reductions in the staff-to-management ratio, and obviously we've gone through significant budget reductions as well. So there's a chart in there about reductions in staff. We reduced our FTE from 233 in 1993 to 207 in 2005, and that's about a 7% reduction in staff over the last 10 years. Then you look at the ratio of management to staff. We've basically really dramatically reduced the number of managers compared to the number of staff we have. Managers represented 25% of the FTE in 1993, but are only 16% of the FTE in 2005. So we're really bringing that ratio down. And we've also seen a reduction in a budget. You've seen it pretty dramatically reduced over the last three biennium. The general fund appropriation has gone down over the last three biennium. So let's look at some ways that we're able, given the budget situation, to control costs in the agency. We've been really, this agency has really been at the forefront in terms of business practices. And they're now being adopted throughout state government, and we're very proud of our record in controlling costs. Because we're separate from DAS, we're a separate agency, we have been able to innovate in ways that the rest of government is just really starting to catch up to now. In fact, we routinely buy supplies and equipment for less than the DAS negotiated price. Let me give you an example. We recently purchased uninterruptible power supply equipment for county elections offices, and our purchasing people were able to save $1,000 per unit more than the DAS Smart Buy program on a $30,000 expenditure. Now, that may not sound like a lot, but it sure does add up if you keep operating and keep finding ways to save money above the existing Smart Buy program. Now, I want to be clear, though, that despite our independence from DAS, we have voluntarily followed all of the DAS spending restrictions, and we found even more cost savings on our own. So we're independent of DAS, but we really work very closely with DAS and follow their guidelines to operate our agency. So I want to talk about performance measures, but I want to take a moment to explain the difficulty of defining performance measures for at least some of the work.
What's wrong with DAS if you can buy stuff cheaper than they can? I mean, what's the problem here? Seems to me that you would buy things together at the lowest possible price.
Yeah.
For the record, Jeff Morgan, I'm the director of the Business Service Division and have been a central purchasing analyst at DAS in years past. And typically, DAS will establish a price agreement for a particular product, and that price agreement will establish pricing for a specified period of time, say, for instance, a year. So that's a price that's contracted. We are able to go out and look at the DAS contract price, and based on the value of the procurement, we would either do a formal procurement or an informal, get three quotes, and we've just been able to go out and look at the price, go out to get quotes, and have accomplished getting better pricing in some cases. In other cases, we do use the DAS price agreements as well for some of the computer buys with the multi-state contract that was awarded and so forth. But we can look at price and then go out and compare, and if we can get a better deal, we do that.
So as an insider, a former insider with DAS, you know where all the prices are.
Yes.
And they're probably suffering because you left, right?
Well, that could be debatable, Senator Morissette.
Okay, that's interesting.
I think a follow-up question is, what percentage of your purchases are you purchasing at less than DAS rates?
I don't have that, but I would be happy to provide that information to you. We keep a log of all our purchases, what's bought on the price agreement, what's not bought on the price agreement.
I wouldn't ask you to do something special. I'm just interested in just a general number. If it's an outlier, you know, that you find once in a while, that's one thing. If it's consistently...
Yeah, then DAS is in trouble.
And we have DAS coming back.
I know.
Senator Morris, I would say that this is less of an issue now than it has been in the past. I think, I mean, to give DAS due, they have made a great deal of progress with their Smart Buy program, and whereas this used to be a consistent pattern. I think it is more of an outlier at this point, but it's something we look at with every purchase we make, whether there's a better deal to be had out there than the DAS contract. I mean, we don't just rush to the DAS contract and assume that's the best deal there is.
Thank you.
Okay. So I'm moving into the area of talking about performance measures, and I wanted to talk for a minute about the difficulty we have sometimes using performance measures for the work we do. And the best example of that difficulty is the voter's pamphlet. We are required by law to produce a voter's pamphlet, and basically the specifications of the voter's pamphlet are specified in law. We presume that the purpose of the voter's pamphlet is to create an informed electorate. I mean, that's a good assumption. However, without polling, we really have no way to measure how much the public values or uses the voter's pamphlet. We mail it out, but we don't really have a way to figure out how they're using it. Now, we're really open to suggestions. We would love to have suggestions on how we ought to measure this. And if the committee would like us to spend money on polling to determine the value of the voter's pamphlet, we certainly would do that. But in our current situation, we simply really cannot know if the voter's pamphlet is in fact assisting to create a better informed electorate. We just know that we mail it out. But given those constraints about things like the voter's pamphlet, let's look at some performance measures for our public service divisions. And let me say at the start that we would really be happy to return to a more detailed discussion of the performance measures after I've given this this overview. So the goal of the Archives Division is to provide complete public access to public records. Now, we maintain up-to-date records retention schedules and provide free and timely access to the entire body of Oregon administrative rules. With over 30,000 pages of Oregon information online, we offer the most information of any state government website in the country. So, and if you look at the, you all have a slide that's talking about performance measures and outcomes for archives. Yeah, Audits Division. Audits Division complies with all of the state and federal audit standards, and we received a very positive review recently from the National State Auditors Association for the outstanding work of the Audits Division. They come around every couple of years and check to see how public auditors are doing, and we got a very clean bill of health and a very high recommendation from them, which we're very honored to have.
Now, may I ask you? Yeah, thank you. Those are activities that you're reporting. You're not telling us what your performance measure goal is. I mean, you're telling us about great things that you've done. Is that, what has that got to do with?
If you look at the slides, yeah. If you look at the slide, you'll see measures and outcomes.
Yeah. So you want to preserve what you're doing for archives. I'm sorry. I'm looking at the archives, page 16. Preservation of maintenance of valuable records, ability to so on and so forth. That's great. But is that a performance measure as we, as the legislature defines performance measures, or is that a listing of an activity which you're doing?
I think, Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, particularly as it relates to the Archives Division, we have really struggled to come up with effective performance measures. I mean, for administrative rules, we publish administrative rules. You know, I am hard pressed And, you know, and I will confess I spent a lot of time thinking about this in the last several weeks to come up with what would be an effective performance measure. I mean, are more rules good? I would hesitate to say that publishing more rules, I mean, we publish rules that are sent to us by other state agencies. I mean, we could have a performance measure that said we will meet our statutory requirement to get them published on time and could give you a chart that shows we do that 100% of the time and we'll continue to do that 100% of the time. I'm not sure that's terribly informative or useful. You know, preserving legislative records.
And I understand what you're saying. Now, the one performance measure that you did refer to that I think would be interesting, is, but it would cost money, is how do you know, you know, we're going to find out how effective the voter's pamphlet is. That would be, could be a performance measure, but right. Then I don't know what it would take to do that. That's a cost item. But that would be interesting. That right. Would be, and to make it more effective. Now, you do it online, do you also?
The voter's pamphlet?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yes.
Okay.
But, I mean, that's, I understand the difficulty for some, you know, the nature of the agency, it's hard to do a performance measure that shows an increase in what you're doing. If you're doing something to the max, and, you know, how do you top that is difficult sometimes. But that's what we're here to question you on.
Right.
So.
Right, and we're ready to really have a full discussion of performance measures and on the various agents of the divisions.
If I may, our plan was to just sort of run through this overview, give the big picture, and then go through the performance measure,
the individual
performance measures one by one. And if that's good. I mean, if you want, we're certainly at your pleasure terms of how you
want. I wasn't sure. You're starting at the end, and I didn't know if we were going to be finished when we got through it. Thank you.
Okay. So, another division is the audits division, where we, as I was saying, we're very honored to have the positive review from the National State Auditors Association. And our yearly financial audit of the state of Oregon is required in order to receive over $6 billion in federal funds. So it's clearly an important role. Of course, in addition to operating properly, the audit division operates effectively. Each dollar spent on performance audits returns $8 in cost savings. Over 80% of the recommendations in our audit reports are implemented by the agencies audited, and we expect to identify over $30 million in potential cost savings for the 2003-05 biennium. So, and some of those, as you can see on the chart, some of those relate to performance measures. Now, for the corporations division, they're basically very involved in e-government and developing e-government services. The online filing services make business easier, and we're working with other agencies, as I said, to create the centralized business registry as a one-stop shop to meet all the registration needs. And when we asked our customers, 94% of them were happy with the services they received at the corporations division. So you can see two performance measures related to those efforts. And I mentioned earlier the difficulty of measuring the performance of the voter's pamphlet. So instead of measuring its effectiveness, we have measured the cost per page. Now, I do want to note that a cheap voter's pamphlet is not necessarily an easy-to-read voter's pamphlet, and it's not necessarily a voter's pamphlet that is effective with the public. But it is a measure that we can, in fact, track. And you can see there's a measure there on the chart. Now, we've also made significant progress in providing more elections information to the public by putting it online, and we're working to make campaign finance laws clearer and easier to follow, and there are some performance measures related to that. So, that's been an overview, and we are ready to go back through the performance measures very specifically after I get done. I'm almost done, but after I get done with the overview. And I just want to talk for a second about technology, because technology plays a really key role in this agency. And the reason for that is that information is what binds this agency together, and technology is how we get information out to the people who want it. And we're working hard to make information about government more accessible to Oregonians, whether they're here in Salem or in the Burns Public Library or in their living room in Astoria. That's really our goal.
I think that's a great goal, and because you're constantly expanding your, I think that's a good performance measure to you know, track what your goal is in terms of expanding the public access. That's good.
Okay, great. That would be one we hadn't actually put. That's good. We'll add that.
Okay, good.
That's great. So let me just give you a couple of examples of our technology project. And if you look at the slide on examples of online services, there's a big long list. But we're making campaign finance information more accessible to the public over the Internet. And I really would encourage each of you to look at the online Blue Book, because the Blue Book that we publish is, you know, this thick. But if you were to print the online Blue Book, it would be to the ceiling. I mean, it's thousands of pages more information about Oregon culture, Oregon art, Oregon history. And it's updated every day. So you can really go on the online Blue Book and see who the current mayor of Silverton is. And the old, you know, the printed Blue Book, that might change in the two-year period between when it's published and when the new one's published. So it's,
can we Google that?
I'm sure you can.
I'm sure you
can. Yes, yes. I'm sure you can.
We can Google the Blue Book, huh?
I think so.
Absolutely. I'll try. Or bluebook.state.org.
Well, no, I'm interested in what, when we visited the Revenue Department and looked at the mapping area, I asked the question about, is all of this stuff on Google? And they said, we can tell by the hits that we're getting that it probably is. Do you keep track of hits that you get?
Yes, we do.
Okay, that's okay.
Good. So the other thing I want to point out is this is the first year we had online, real-time election results available on the web. And I really am very proud of that accomplishment, because for many, 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 well, since the beginning of running elections in the state, the Secretary of State's office has been reliant on the press to collect statewide election results. So it was really a real step forward for us to be publishing on the web in real time election results.
Now, I'm sorry, may I ask? I'm a little bit confused here, because I've tried to find on election night, for instance, Senator Verger was listed in three different counties, I believe, and I had to look at the county returns. Could I have found her entire thing on the...
Yes, on our website.
I didn't know that.
Yes.
Good.
And that, yeah, you've got your finger right on the frustration. That is sort of like, and then you're sort of dependent on AP or who are, they have all these bureaus that, I mean, they have all these stringers that work for them.
See, that's a great performance measure, too, that you're doing all this new stuff. That's what you need to be putting down.
Okay. So let me talk about Oregon Progress Board benchmarks. There are two of them that affect our agency. Benchmark 31 relates to voter turnout. The benchmark calls for us to have the highest vote. The goal is to have the highest voter turnout in the country. And benchmark 35, which relates to public management quality, which is within the, obviously, voter turnout is in the province of the Elections Division, and public management quality is in the province of the Audits Division. I have to say that Oregon came really close to meeting the benchmark in terms of having the highest turnout in the country. We had 86.5% of our registered voters, who put us as third in the country, and we were the highest state of states that have that don't have same day election registration.
May I? Do you take credit for that?
No.
Okay.
I don't.
It's not a performance measure.
It's interesting. I would say it's very interesting that the elections division is assigned a benchmark that has to do with voter turnout, when the reality is 1,000 different groups, whether it be presidential elections or ballot measure campaigns, really worked to get turnout.
Okay.
I absolutely don't. It would be really ludicrous for me to take credit for that.
Well, except that, the vote by mail.
That helps.
Helps, and right. That's something I think that came through the Secretary of State's office.
Right. So. And vote by mail helps particularly, oddly enough, not in general elections, presidential general elections, it helps there too, but you particularly see an increase in turnout in traditionally lower turnout elections because of vote by mail. School board elections, budget levies, maybe the primary election as well. You see more of an increase because of vote by mail.
I would wonder, and I don't think that you need to go back and figure out objectively how to show this, but it really appears to me that your office has been very instrumental in affecting voter turnout, not just in support and enhancement of the vote by mail, but also in what looks to me to be marketing of voter registration,
right.
Making sure that we maintain a good voter's pamphlet, which I think helps the electorate understand elections, which makes it easier for them to vote. I don't think it would be too far a stretch that you should take some credit for that.
Okay.
Put it down.
Well, if I can add just a note here, one of the issues, Senator, that we've wrestled with is our audits division has been critical of other agencies for using benchmarks and taking credit for things of which
they don't
have much control. And so they're
we handed you this one. You could probably just shut up and we'd be just fine right now.
I understand, but they're in sort of an internal break on me wanting to, wave the flag and take credit for things in our agency from the audits division to say, there are 1,000 factors that go in to voter turnout, and we may have been 2 or 3 of them, but does that mean we can take credit for all of that?
Don't take credit for the 2 or 3 that you are responsible for, is what I think what we're getting at, isn't it? There are some things you're doing to increase voter turnout, and I think those are things that you should be trying to improve on and increase. You're part of it.
And I do think we are more directly involved, particularly in voter registration efforts. There are a lot of groups that did voter registration. But we promoted voter registration through billboards and ads on TV. So that was part of our expenditure of Help America Vote Act money. So
Could you explain the difference between registered voters and eligible voters, because you have two different ratios there?
Not as far as I know.
No, the eligible voters is people who are would include all of the voting age population, including people who have chosen not to register, people who are legally qualified to register to vote. So essentially any non-incarcerated citizen who's been here for 30 days, whether they choose to vote, whether they choose to register to vote or not. So that's a broader category, including non-registered but eligible citizens.
Okay, and then the other benchmark is benchmark 35 relating to public management quality, and the Progress Board was using the governing magazine ranking of various states in terms of management quality. They're now in a debate. The Progress Board is now in a debate whether they want to continue to use that ranking. We see the audits division as having a role in that, and we feel that particularly with the focus on performance audits, we've seen public management quality improving. We've seen an identification of cost savings, and we feel good about the ratio of spending a dollar and identifying eight in potential cost savings. So,
question with respect to your savings, is that over the life cycle of the activity, or is that on a biannual basis or an annual basis? If you invest a dollar 1 year and the savings, is that then calculated on a year basis or indeterminate amount of time, or how do you calculate your cost savings? And then the second question we have is, how do we follow it up to make sure that in fact those savings have been preserved?
If I may, Mr. Chair, the answer to the first part of your question is that depends. Most are on relatively short term, and we're sort of not like Congress and spinning out budget projections for 20 years, and so most are readily identifiable, some a biennium, some two biennia, but I'm not aware of any where these numbers are, you know, many biennia. And so it is an attempt to look at identify real savings in the near term, but not every audit identifies savings in exactly the same way, just because they look at such different things, from construction projects to ongoing efforts, and I mean they're not all apples, I guess is how I would answer that question.
Thank you. It seems to me if you improve the process, that saved money in the process is put in place over a period of time, you could project something out. It would be an apple and apple thing, I think, which may not be a bad thing. Is if you, in, you know, that could be a significant saving over a period of time. If by a simple change in the way people do things, that came from your audit, I think. You know, so I think that also could be something that you could list as a significant savings over a long period of time, as long as they stayed with that way of doing things. Do you find those things in your audits?
Well, let's take, for example, the audit we did of the lottery. And we identified about $800,000 in potential savings in just in the administration, the administrative costs of administering the lottery. Okay, we're not talking about commissions to retailers. We're not talking about prizes. We're just talking about administrating the lottery. And we identified about $800,000. Now that's $800,000. In potential savings for a biennial budget. I mean,
that's correct.
Right? So if you save that money in this biennium, you're not going to be spending that money in subsequent bienniums. So you can put any whatever multiplier you want on it. But we have tracked that one because our audits division has gone back to the lottery to see. And when they went back, the lottery had already saved $500,000 of the $800,000 that was recommended, and the new lottery director had implemented all 21 of the money-saving measures that had been recommended by the lottery. By the audit. Yeah. So, you know, well, that's an example.
What's wrong with saying that? I mean, it seems to me that if you come up with a way of saving money that is continued on and on, then that is a significant long-term saving. I mean, I don't, you know, I just don't see why that.
Again, if I may, this is you know, part of the joy of having accountants and auditors working for you. I mean, that $800,000 is reflected in these numbers once.
Right.
And it is, those are ongoing savings, and you know, we take credit for them once.
Right.
And you know, I think potentially we've been doing the Secretary of State's been the Auditor of Public Accounts since 1859, and you know, I don't know. I mean, we'd have to figure out some structure and how far back we could look.
Mr. Chair,
it could be more. That number potentially could be bigger than the state budget, right, which makes it ridiculous.
Well,
but
really.
you know, so I don't know how.
A little asterisk or parentheses, you know, projected over 20 years, it would be this much money. That, you know, you don't have to take credit for it. But I think that would be
a minute ago they didn't want to take credit for everything. Now he says they've saved more than the entire state budget. your benchmark 35 on page 21, where you say every dollar spent on performance audits returns $8 in potential savings, is the one example you just gave of the $800,000 something that could fairly be attributed within that statement?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
It might be helpful to be more specific in terms of the time, $8 per biennium. Or,
okay.
I think you ought to put a little asterisk down and somewhere tell the full story and say that, you know, if the procedure remains in place over 20 years, it could be a huge amount of money. And I think you ought to say that. Instead of, you know, you can take credit for doing it once, but somewhere put a footnote that gives the big picture. And I don't think you would be at all out of line in taking credit for that. Then when you retire, you can say, this is what I did when I was Secretary of State.
Well, legacy.
A legacy.
Then the next legislator that they come along and present to will say, why are you doing that?
That's right. So, just to conclude, what are the biggest budget issues facing this office? Obviously, our major budget drivers include our technology projects, such as Central Business Registry and new complicated audit standards. And I want to talk about those for a minute. The Government Accounting Standards Board, also known as GASB, they've adopted GASB, I think it's 34, which has really raised the bar on auditing standards, and it's done it significantly. Because of the new auditing standards, we've shifted from 2/3 of our audit dollars being spent on discretionary audits and 1/3 being spent on required annual audit of the federal funds or other financial audits. We now see exactly the opposite ratio. 2/3 of our audit dollars are being spent on either mandatory or the financial audit or the mandatory kinds of audits, and only 1/3 of the money we have available for audits is spent on discretionary audits. And I just have to say that really raises a concern for me, because I've seen significant improvements through the discretionary audits. We do the performance audits are all discretionary. And you see real savings found and real efforts at effectiveness improvement through those kind of audits. And so it's a real concern to me to see the ratio shifting the way it's shifting. Let me talk for a minute about our program option packages. Basically, our POPs are designed around our primary goals of government integrity, accountability, and providing information to the public. First POP is the POP that provides for a funding mechanism for us to audit K-12 schools. And although in your budget documents you'll see that we asked for $1.3 million, we're reducing that to $500,000 to do performance audits of K-12 schools to get started. It's real clear that these audits can find savings in support services like transportation and facilities construction, and will help us bring more money into the classroom where it belongs, and that's the goal of the audits. As I said, we found for every dollar we spend on performance audits in state government, we found $8 in savings, and there's no reason to believe that similar savings can't be found in K through 12 schools. So that's a pop.
Excuse me, question.
Mr. Secretary, is there a is this still more on a conceptual basis, or is there actually some kind of a plan on how you would go about choosing which districts to audit, or whether you would do all of them on a rotating basis? Or I'm just curious how far along we are in the thinking.
It's developed to the point where our chief auditor, Kathy Polino, has developed a proposal of how that $500,000 would be spent. And it really, there's sort of two levels to it. One level is basically responding to requests from school districts for audits. That's number one. And, for example, Jerry Colonna, who's the head of the Beaverton schools. I had a great meeting with him, and he said he would be the first to sign up for a performance audit. So that's part of it, is offering the performance audit service and then basically having that audit service paid for through the $500,000 from basic school support rather than by the individual district. That's really what the proposal is. The second part of it is that our auditors want to do what I would call cross-cutting audits. In other words, look at information technology in five or six school districts, and so that you really find what some common problems are and what some really good common solutions could be to make sure that they're making the most effective and efficient use of data technology, information technology. That's an example.
That is very helpful. I've got two follow-ups to that. One of them is the federal money that you're using in order to pay for this. I think it's federal money. Is that right? No. Okay.
No.
Okay. The source is what then?
Well, the proposal is to $500,000 from the Basic School Support Fund. It's basically making audits of K through 12 schools similar to the way we audit state agencies. Because all state agencies pay a small fee for the audit service.
Right.
And then we decide who to audit and what to audit.
Okay.
Okay. So the idea would be for schools, instead of having to bill an individual school,
right,
the idea would be just have basic school support pay that cost up front.
Talk for just a minute, if you will, about why the Secretary of State's office is in the best position to perform that type of a function, and then why school districts as opposed to other local jurisdictions such as cities, which are subdivisions of the state of Oregon as well.
Let me answer your second question first. We don't spend $5 billion supporting cities. Cities get money from local property taxpayers and other enterprise funds, and the state does not spend a lot of money on cities, or for that matter on counties, although there are some health services that obviously go through to counties, and we do audit them. I mean, that part of it. So that's why schools stand out. There's been such a huge shift in the last 10 years from how schools get their money. I mean, basically two-thirds of the money for local schools comes from the state general fund. You know this better than I do. So that's the reason why the auditor of state accounts should be auditing schools as well as state agencies, because they're two-thirds of their money comes from the state. So then what was the first question?
Let me give you a primer for the first one, which is why the Secretary of State's office, as opposed, for instance, to the legislative branch of government or some other source in tracking that money.
Well, The reason it's very logical for us to be proposing this, because we have an audits division that does performance audits on state agencies now, and they have a proven track record. I feel great about the job they do, and I think all of us can look at the results. And so it just makes sense, rather than creating a whole new audits division, it makes sense to add this to the responsibilities of the existing audits division of the Secretary of State.
And if I can add to that, Representative Avakian, I think there is a constitutional problem with the legislature creating its own audits division. There's an Attorney General's opinion from when Norma Paulus was Secretary of State, and interestingly, there was a Republican Secretary of State and a Democratic legislature which was trying to establish its own audit function, and there was an Attorney General's opinion that said auditing is a constitutional function of the Secretary of State, and unless there's a constitutional amendment, the Secretary of State is the auditor of public accounts.
Okay, thank you.
Kind of a follow-up question to this line is, what would be the difference between a Secretary of State's performance audit and a district's financial audit?
Huge difference. And basically, the financial audits that are done by local CPA firms for local school districts are basically establishing that the money is, in fact, accounted for properly and legally. And they don't, CPAs will tell you that they don't look at whether this is the most efficient or effective way to accomplish the goal. They look at whether the money that was spent is spent legally. And that's what current CPAs review for local school districts. A performance audit really looks at, okay, you have established some goals, and how are you getting to those goals, and are there more efficient ways for you to achieve those goals? And I think there are just phenomenal opportunities, given that there are, 197 school districts and 13 or 14 ESDs, phenomenal opportunity given all the facilities that schools manage, given the transport. I mean, they are transportation systems. There are 197 transportation systems. So there are just real opportunities for potential savings in those operations. And CPAs don't look at how could the school district run a bus system more efficiently. They just look to make sure that the money was spent legally doing the things that the bus system required.
Thank you. You mentioned Jerry Colonna from Beaverton. Charlie Ringo, Senator Ringo from Beaverton, wants to cut back significantly on the ESDs. That is a huge issue now in our Senate, in our Education Committee.
Yes.
And there are 20 ESDs.
Thank you.
They're trying to cut.
I wasn't sure.
Well, yeah, there are 20. But well, I have a real problem with eliminating significantly ESDs and cutting services because of small districts. Now, are there audits? Do you guys have you audited the ESD system, or you haven't?
No.
Well, I think that's probably the first thing that should be done before we decide to eliminate or cut back significantly on the ESD system, and particularly Beaverton, which affects a lot of rural communities around there, and that's very controversial. So I don't know where we start on that issue. But
if I can offer a real-life example of the difference between a financial and performance audit, in the news, the Baker Union ESD, a financial audit would look at whether a plane was paid for out of the appropriate funds. A performance audit would look at the efficacy of having an airplane.
Right.
Thank you. I wanted to have you address that because I.
No, it's a very good question. Excellent question.
And I apologize if while my head was poked out the door, you addressed this, but this notion of doing the audits for the school districts, and some of that money is being paid for from the account that you mentioned. I'm wondering if there's an opportunity at some point for this to be a revenue generating source. for your office, meaning the districts have to have audits done in one way or another. They're either going to go out, they're going to purchase that from a private auditor or from something, and it seems to me that you might be able to recoup some of your costs and do it cheaper than they may be able to go out and find in the private sector. And there might be a benefit to both.
Representative Akian, two things. One is, as we propose to do performance audits on schools, we very consciously have not wanted to be competing with local CPAs that do financial audits. It would take a lot of staff people to do the financial audits on 197 school districts and 20 ESDs. It would take a lot of people, a lot of staff. So in that instance, what we would probably do is contract out with local CPAs, which we do now for some kinds of audits. So I'm not sure that it really makes sense for us to move into that area. I mean, I don't know. That's my sense.
As a follow-up, one of the things we are very proud of in the audits division is the fact that the cost of our auditors is below what we pay for contracting auditing. That is true when our auditors are here in Salem. If they're in enterprise, we're paying travel costs and per diem, and right, that may not be true.
If I may. And I wasn't, by asking you the question, implying that I think you should do that. The thought was sparked when you said that at least at the beginning, it's a voluntary thing. People are coming to ask you to do it, and I'm sure they're doing that because they see some benefit to you doing it as opposed to somebody else doing it. And it seemed maybe a more natural type of arrangement in that situation.
Well, let me just, Representative Yakim, let me be real clear. They can't come to us and ask. We're not proposing that they be able to come to us and ask to do a financial audit like local CPAs have to do. We're proposing that they be able to come to us to get a performance audit. And that's really, there are a few firms where you can go, large accounting firms where you can get a performance audit, but not too many. The fact is we are really experts in that.
To follow up this line of questioning again, your proposal is that the districts would have an elective, not a mandatory, access to your auditors? In other words, who's the driver? District asking for a performance audit?
The Secretary of State is the auditor of state accounts, and we would be saying that school districts are part of state accounts. So the Secretary of State would still be the driver, but the proposal is to offer performance audit services to school districts, A, and B, to do some what I've called cross-cutting audits, which we would decide where we needed to do those cross-cutting audits. So we are basically maintaining our constitutional position as the auditor and not saying, well, you can just do it if you want. I mean, we are maintaining our position as auditor so that we could go in, but we think the best thing to do is to start this process by having people come to us and ask for performance audits, because they really can be beneficial, and many school districts recognize that.
One thing that would be quite beneficial would be once you are into the system and really examining it, you develop a level of expertise that can then immediately translate into, you know, from one district to another in terms of systems, procedures, things that can be replicated or eliminated, and it could have a very positive impact from just an expertise standpoint.
Thank you. Can I put an amendment in the bill for the ESDs that the Secretary of State shall do an audit before we mess with the reorganization of ESDs?
If we give them money. Sure.
No, you have discretion.
Cool.
I'm very concerned about the ESD issue because it's been studied over the years a number of times, and we're doing it again, and I'm afraid we're going to do something that we that's rash, and we don't know what's going on now. Have you done an ESD audit recently?
We've never done it.
You've never
that I am aware of, Senator. I would be happy to have Kathy Polino, the state auditor.
Yeah, I'd like to do that because I'm. Short order. I would really like to perhaps suggest something like that before we rush off and do something that will do harm. You know, our first thing is do no harm. We don't want to do harm.
Senator, you just turned their 10% cut list into a doubling of their staff.
Yes. The money you save from the ESDs will pay for it.
Mr. Chair and Senator Morissette, I just want to add a little note here, which is I represented the Southern Oregon coast in the legislature, and one of the, you know, the South Coast ESD was a critical provider of service to the local school district. So I that's a lot of small school districts.
Yeah.
So I certainly can understand the concern that you have.
Just before we do that, our chair is back, but I was just going to ask the question, do we have a hearing tomorrow again with Secretary of State? So I didn't want to lose track of our schedule and our task at hand in the handout here, so go ahead.
I'll tell you what, why don't you continue to chair just until I can get a little bit caught up?
Well, we're not going too far right now, so.
Oh, okay.
So there's not much catch up.
Well,
we've got a great discussion.
Yeah,
okay.
I'm just one last comment on that. We attended our education committee met in Roseburg on the ESD issue, and we had the South Coast ESD and the Douglas ESD, and we also had the model of reorganization, which would mean that the Lane ESD would serve the South Coast, which would mean you would have to establish a satellite office to save any money and so on. And
right.
So I would hope that that is an issue that is looked at before we do a reorganization. And I will seriously consider an amendment to any bill that comes along. But I need to talk with you about how to go about, you know, to say that there should be an audit done before we make significant changes. So thank you.
Mr. Chair, that was K through 12 audits. Okay, that was one of our POPs. Let me talk about a couple other POPs. One of the really important POPs we have is the $700,000 general fund POP. And what that does is,
Mr. Secretary, I'm going to interrupt you for just a second. I just needed a minute to get caught up with staff. In the first phase of the presentations, the co-chairs have asked us, as informative as the discussion has been on some of the policy option packages, to get through the priorities, the performance measures, and the 10% reductions, and that we are scheduled to get into your policy option packages in the next phases.
Okay.
So may I direct respectfully the discussion back to the priorities and the 10% reductions and the performance measures?
You can direct the discussion forward.
Thank you.
I will now not talk about any more about POPs.
Thank you. So I'm trying to stay out of trouble with the coaches.
From the back of the book to the front of the book now.
Talking specifically about the prioritized list of Secretary of State programs, you have a prioritized list that we submitted.
Mr. Secretary, could you guide us to the page where you were?
I can't, but you can.
Appendix C. The first replacement page is reported.
And did you put the replacement? Thank you. Okay, now we're all up to speed.
Okay, and we all are looking at replacement pages, I guess. Okay, basically we've prioritized our program so that we can first meet our constitutional and then our statutory mandates and then provide the internal support services that are necessary to all of our public services and then meet our federal mandates and finally provide the public with information about government, corporations, and elections. That's basically a very high overview level of how we prioritize. We started with our constitutional and then statutory mandates and then the internal support that supports those and then moved through federal mandates, which there's a lot of stuff in elections related to federal mandates. and then other things about information. So that's if you want to talk more about that, we certainly are welcome. We can do that, or I can just finish real briefly my overview, and then we can get into the discussion of prioritization and performance measures.
Let's finish the overview, and then I would very much like to come back to the priority and to have you or whoever is doing the presenting link up. You're saying financial audits are your number one priority based on the fact that you prioritized your constitutional responsibilities first, and if you can then walk through in that depth of detail to make those linkages,
yes,
that would be great. But let's finish
okay.
the high-level overview.
So I'm literally real close here.
Okay.
So I want to just talk about the effect of budget cuts as it specifically relates to the Secretary of State's agency. To my predecessor, Phil Kiesling's credit, I inherited an agency that was already very lean. When I took over in 1999, Phil had done a marvelous job at making reductions. And that was during the 1990s when the rest of state government was really bulking up. Phil Kiesling managed to slim down the Secretary of State's office, and I think he did a great job. It was really the right thing to do, but it leaves us now in a little bit of a bind. Because we didn't have as much bulk to begin with when budget cutting started, and having gone through several seasons of budget slimming, I got to tell you, we're about as slim as we can get. And there really aren't a whole lot more efficiencies left to find in the agency. And it's basically the reality is if we experience more budget cuts, we will have to cut programs or services. It's just we've really gotten to that point where it really is programs and services go. And I think the reality is we have very few employees who do only one thing. And I think that's a great strength in our organization. The elections division is funded primarily by the general fund, and every staff member in elections does every service of elections. So when it's C&E time and C&Es are being filed, all of the elections division is doing C&Es. And when it's initiative time, all of the elections division is doing initiative. So really, we can't just cut a person to cut a program because they all work on it. It basically means that the cuts mean fewer services or not being able to meet our statutory requirements in terms of getting initiatives on the ballot properly.
Senator Morse.
I want to know what you're looking at. Are we looking at what you're looking at?
Oh, what am I looking at?
Well, okay. No, you're reading
a page. I think, Mr. Chair, he has gone to the red tab that's in the very back says Bradbury's high-level overview.
Effects of budget cuts.
What page are you on, Mr. Secretary?
Those are numbered differently.
Well, I know.
Okay.
But it's really,
Okay, 25.
Okay. So there's two.
The very back tab.
Well, we've been through that.
So, as I said, if our budget, particularly our general fund budget, is cut further, our ability to provide election services is going to diminish. I mean, it's just that's where we are.
Mr. Secretary, when you say your ability to perform election services, could you define what all is included in that?
Well, sure. It would be the C&E processing. We have deadlines for contribution and expenditure report. All those reports have to be processed to get into the system. Another specific deadline would be the deadlines that we have for C&E or for initiative filings, and everybody on the staff works on getting to count the signatures, to send to the counties blocks of signatures to check them. Everybody in the office works on getting those ready to be sent out so that we can then meet our deadline. It's actually a constitutional deadline for when we have to certify that there are or are not signatures enough to get something on the ballot. So those are the kind of things, is the C&E processing, the initiative processing, that everybody in the elections office participates in. And so so the reason I say that is that if you reduce the number of election staff, basically we use all of the election staff to meet the deadline for the specific deadline, whether it be for initiatives or, and then we use people, all the staff to process C&Es and stuff when they come in. So it's I question whether we'll be able to meet the statutory deadline specifically on initiatives if we don't have at least the number of staff that we currently have in the elections office.
Senator Morse.
Related question, Mr. Secretary. I have not experienced this, but I have been told by several members that they had filed their CNEs on time, but because of your inability to process them accordingly, that they then received a fine. Is that? Could you elaborate on that
if
circumstance?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, they would not be fined for a late report if it was filed timely, whether that was done electronically or over the counter. I mean, at 5 o'clock on the deadline is our deadline, and so if it's filed electronically by 4:59:59, it's in. If somebody's in the door or in line at 4:59, it's in. If they fax it to us at 5:03, it's late. If the fax machine is busy, if you call at 4:58, that's not our fault. If one relies on technology and technology fails you, then that's not our fault.
This was very specific that the filing was timely, but yet because of it was related to me because of activities within your office that couldn't process it, it was determined to be deficient. And the logic of that just totally escaped me.
Right.
Deficient or late?
Well, late. had not met the timeliness requirements.
I'd be happy to look into the situation for you, Senator.
Okay, well, I may get more specific, okay, and we can address that, but we don't need to do it here now. But I did, since you were talking about not having enough personnel, it made me wonder if there was a nexus here. So.
Well, it also leads me to a question, if personnel are the issue. You're suggesting some new initiatives. The K-12 audits, fraud investigation, other technology enhancements. How can you possibly undertake those new initiatives? I mean, obviously money is the answer, but let's set that aside. We're still operating in a very fiscally constrained environment. Those new initiatives, given your current configuration, are they achievable?
With if they're accompanied with the resources that we've requested, yes, they are. Yeah.
I think, if I may, Madam Chair, I think the point here is that although we have segmented, for example, the Elections Division into programs, that division is not clean. And if we got direction from the legislature to stop C&E enforcement and to eliminate the 7 FTE related to C&E enforcement, that would impact our ability to comply with our constitutional requirements in the initiative and referendum process, because there are times of the year when the people who are C&E people
are doing
initiative and referendum work, and if they were gone because C&E enforcement was not a high enough priority, I don't believe we would be able to meet our constitutional mandate
in terms of initiative and referendum. And I think that's the point the Secretary is trying to make here.
I don't recall where you prioritized C&E. High, low, I just don't recall.
You have a list.
Okay, thank you.
May I?
Senator Morsi.
Yeah. You mentioned constitutional mandate and you mentioned statutory mandate, so you have both.
Right.
And I guess we could change the statutory mandates, but we have to fund the constitutional mandates. Do we know which is which?
I think so.
Ready? Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, in the Constitution, the Secretary is the auditor of public accounts and the keeper of legislative records.
Okay.
And those are the only specific responsibilities related to his office in the Constitution. In statute, he is chief elections officer. However, there are constitutional requirements related to the initiative referendum process in terms of deadline that are imposed upon the Secretary as chief elections officer.
May I follow up?
Please.
Do you indicate that in your budget? So we look down the list and see, hey, this is a constitutional mandate. Do we have to figure that out for ourselves, or are you going to tell us which is which?
May I exercise the prerogative of the chair? They're going to tell us.
Good.
And I think you'll see in our prioritization that's...
Oh, okay, case. Okay. There are citations.
Right.
Yeah, thank you.
So just to conclude, Madam Chair, in a very tight budget environment, which we're all faced with public demand for government accountability and the government desire for public confidence, it's really more important than ever that we invest in the Secretary of State's functions of providing information to keep government open, accessible, transparent, and accountable. And we're hoping to move forward.
Thank you very much, Mr. Secretary. Are there any questions? Absent any questions, then let's move into your prioritization.
Okay. And, Madam Chair, can I take a momentary break to go to the restroom, and Patty and Jeff will walk through prioritization, and I'll be right back.
That would be just fine. Mr. McGuire.
Madam Chair, is your preference for us to start with the 10% reduction list or agency priority list? Help me out.
Well, I think that I may get some guidance from staff. I think it has been the desire of the co-chairs to see how you prioritize, and that leads naturally into the discussion of where you would take reductions. And absent any guidance to the contrary from the professional staff, I think that's where we'd like to go.
All right. So, Madam Chair, looking at the chart labeled department-wide priorities for the governor's recommended budget, our first agency priority is financial audits. This is a constitutional responsibility and is essential if the state of Oregon is going to get some $9 billion in federal funds. If we don't do this, the state comes something like $9 billion short. So we consider that to be our highest priority. Our second agency priority is the Archives Division and maintaining the important records of the state. This is a constitutional requirement, again. This is preserving and protecting the state constitution, legislative records, governor's records, those sorts of things. Our third priority is performance audits. Because of this, again, a constitutional responsibility, and because of the impact across state government of the work of the Audits Division and the savings that are produced across state government, we prioritize that third.
I want to come back to number three, but let's jump up to number two for just a second. I understand that the preservation of Oregon's written record is a constitutional requirement. So set that off to the side. My question to you is whether or not there have been any kinds of discussions inside your office with respect to not only our written record, but also our physical artifacts. And I know that there has been a sort of gentleman's handshake agreement for a long time that the Oregon Historical Society would be charged with the preservation and curation, is that how you say that? Looking at all the
curation.
Of our physical artifacts, and yet we've zeroed out any general fund funding for the Oregon Historical Society. My argument is that 2 million photographs don't take care of themselves. And what I'm leading up to is that we have this elegant building on the mall, or the extended mall, and whether or not you all have made any kinds of policy decisions, or at least had the conversation internally about any opportunities to do things a different way with respect to management of the archives, as well as any perceived or actual responsibilities that we have for the curation of our physical artifacts.
As a rule, Madam Chair, most of the physical artifacts are not in state ownership. So
right.
Our ability to get our hands on these things is somewhat limited. Frankly, the Historical Society's facility is much more attuned to storage of physical things. Photographs are a little bit of an anomaly because basically they're paper. It would be easy for us to store photographs, and we have a lot of photographs in the state archives. There's a pretty amazing collection of photographs from the construction of the Wilson River Highway. As part of the WPA project, they hired photographers to take pictures of this. And, I would encourage all of you, it's a great afternoon to go down to the state archives and just ask them to show you interesting stuff. And there is an amazing amount of interesting stuff. Our facility is designed to store paper, and it's a great facility for storing paper. It is not a great facility for storing other things. And you need a lot of more space to store things that aren't flat and can go in boxes. I think your description of a gentle person's agreement of division of labor is fair. I think we would have serious facility issues if we were to go into a significant effort to accumulate non-paper materials.
Now, jumping down to number three, where you're talking about performance auditing as your third requirement, would you make the linkage for me how that is a constitutional requirement?
We believe, and there are Attorney General's opinions to this point, that auditing is auditing.
Right.
And we see the benefit across state government of our performance auditing work as providing a great benefit to the people of Oregon because of the savings we are able to identify across state government so that we can ensure that resources are managed efficiently.
I think it would be very helpful for the committee were you to provide copies of that opinion to the professional staff, and they'll get it distributed to them.
Yeah, we will do that.
Thank you. Okay.
Do you want me to keep going? Our fourth priority is conduct of elections. This is a statutory requirement, but obviously pretty core to our system of government. Our mission here is to interpret, apply, and enforce election laws uniformly. Our fifth priority is a business registry in the Corporation Division. This is primarily a ministerial function, but we've done a lot of really interesting work in recent years to expand cooperation between state agencies and sharing information, and we'll have some more information about that when we get to performance measures.
May I again stop you and ask you, I agree with your comments about elections, and I think most people think of when they think of the Secretary of State's office, they think elections. So I guess my curiosity is, you placed elections lower because it's not constitutional. Then how come the components of the election are really lower, like the voter's pamphlet?
You know, I mean, this is prioritizing functions is really difficult. I mean, I think we would argue that that the voter's pamphlet is a fairly discrete function that is expendable if need be. I mean, I think it provides a fabulous public service, but it's sort of one of the only parts of the elections division that you could carve out and eliminate, and we could continue to function. And so that was a factor in putting it low.
That says it all.
Yeah, please.
We still have an election with our pamphlet, I guess.
Senator Morris.
Thank you. You said it much better than I did. Thank
all
you
right.
very much.
So I think now we're on number six.
Number six. The initiative and referendum process. This is partly statutory, partly constitutional, is probably as central to what Oregon is as any other government function.
I just happened to be perusing the list of initiatives that have come in. It probably changed since yesterday. Yeah. And at last count, there were 36 of them, I think. Or how many are there now?
I don't know. Yeah.
Say 36 for the sake of conversation. With more anticipated, I would presume.
Oh, sure.
How is this year teeing up historically in terms of volume and complexity of the ones that you know about now?
I think my assessment is it's decidedly average. I haven't looked at, and so I'm sort of relying on recollection of timing and such, because that's not something I've looked at recently. But I mean, we do an internal review of every initiative, and so they all come through our office for a review in terms of single subject, and I believe, Madam Chair, that it's my assessment that this is a fairly average year. Bill Sizemore has been recently active. He was sort of out of a lot of activity in the last cycle, and so our last cycle numbers were down a little bit. He's filed a number of initiatives this year. I think he's already filed more this year than he had in the last two-year cycle, and so who knows?
But decidedly average is how you would characterize it as of right now.
Yes, Madam Chair.
There has been some legislation discussed in this building that would cause, if it's successful, would cause the legislature to play a role in the initiative and petition process to the degree that debate would occur in this building, fiscal impact statements developed to a finer degree, advisory votes taken by both houses. Do you have any opinion about the initiative process right now with respect to the handling in your office and a greater or lesser involvement by the legislature in looking at initiatives?
Madam Chair, I guess my first answer would be my job is to process the initiatives that come in as effectively and efficiently as possible. I don't have any opinion specifically on any specific legislative proposal to change the process. It was, one little note, it was interesting yesterday to be in Seattle and be reminded of how different the initiative process is in Washington, in that they anyone who wants to submit an initiative submits with a certain number of signatures to the legislature. The legislature then has a session to potentially either refer the measure or refer some version of the measure, and the sponsor then has the choice of either pursuing their own initiative, getting enough signatures, or, you know, being happy with what the legislature referred. It's very interesting. I mean, I find it very interesting.
Representative Rockin.
Fully recognizing that you may not want to or be able to address it, without talking about the specific legislation, I mean, I think there is an issue that Patty touched on earlier about this whole notion of the initiative process almost being like a fourth branch of government in some respects. But can you give us any guidance on which branch of government you think ought to be administering that initiative process? Because some of the legislation may or may not blur that line or shift management of the process. Some people question whether or not the legislative branch should be involved in the management of an initiative process. So from a systems perspective,
I
wasn't implying anybody wanted it,
but I mean, the reality is, I mean, the legislature is generally a legislative body. It's not an executive branch. The legislature generally is not an administrative body. It seems to me that it would be appropriate for the administration of the initiative process to be handled by an executive agency. I mean, it just seems logical.
And Madam Chair, if I can say just one word as follow-up to your question, I think the one piece of legislation that I'm aware of that would most directly impact our work and our budget is the requirement for more signatures to get a ballot title. We spend an awfully lot of money. We pay for the legal work at the Attorney General's office to write ballot titles. And so everybody who walks in with 25 signatures triggers about $1,500 out of the Elections Division budget to the Attorney General's office for that ballot title process. If there was a way to reduce the number of ballot titles that are written, that would have a not insubstantial impact on the fees we pay to the Attorney General.
Right. Thank you. Okay, I think we are now down on your priority number 7.
We next go through a group of the internal support functions. I mean, this is sort of the difficulty here was where you put these on the priority list, because doing the six things above would be pretty much impossible without these things. But so we sort of stuck them high, but not the highest priorities, obviously. Payroll, cash management, purchasing, our human resources function, our information systems functions, and the executive office take you down through 16. And I'm happy to talk about any of those individually or collectively.
Committee, any questions about those, or just say that's the back room and move to 17?
Back room.
Okay, back room.
It's a legislative term.
Next, we have legislatively required but constitutionally authorized financial management audits. These are of a lower priority than the federal audit. And if we don't do these, it isn't a $9 billion hit to the state budget. But these are financial compliance audits, required change of directors audits, that sort of thing.
When is a change of director audit required?
Whenever a director changes.
At what size agency, though?
Any agency.
Okay.
So, which is, and we really have, Madam Chair, changed the scope of change of director's audits. They used to be considerably more expansive than they are now, and we found over time that they rarely yielded much value to anyone. It now, in a small agency, consists of sort of going in and making sure that the checklist is followed, that keys were returned, that timesheets were done, that look at the last 6 months of payroll and travel to make sure there isn't anything completely odd there. They are much more lean now and less expensive now than they used to be, and that was just sort of on the cost-benefit basis. We found there wasn't much there.
Oh, Monica.
Members of the committee, I believe there is also pending legislation that came out of the Interim Audit Committee around change of director's audit and freeing up to essentially say if there are other risk criteria out there that would make it valuable or important for the audit division to go in, then they could go in, but changing whether it was mandatory on every change of director. But I don't remember the bill number, but I believe it's in the House side, and it came out of that interim committee, so they're planning to adjust that.
That's very helpful. Number 18.
Thank you very much. Number 18 is our work with the Uniform Commercial Code, which is essential for the state's credit system to work properly. 19 is the Notary Public.
Mr. McGuire, I'm going to ask that the professional staff flag 18. I would like to come back to that in the absence of our colleague, Representative Smith. This panel is also charged with doing the Department of Revenue's budget, and we are looking for those connect points between your shop and the Department of Revenue and filers that have failed to file, non-filers, and the recording of liens. And I think we'd like to have a more thorough and thoughtful discussion on that, and I'm asking the professional staff to flag that.
And I believe, Madam Chair, that we have been in discussions with the Department of Revenue, and we'll have some good news for you on that front very shortly.
Good. I think that suggestion, I want to give credit where credit's due. Representative Smith's suggestion may be one of the winners for this committee if it's an opportunity to affect compliance in a way heretofore undone. Good. All right. 19,
Notary Public System. This is an essential function, as far as we're concerned, for the transaction of business throughout the state. 20 is the Elections Division contribution and expenditures.
Let's go back to 19. Is 19 paid for through fees generated by those persons wishing to become notary publics?
Madam Chair, I am not certain. I need to check. I know the system generates fees. Whether it is sufficient to run the entire program, I am not certain.
Would you please get that information back to the professional staff?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Number 20, contribution and expenditures in the Elections Division. Again, the problem here with pulling the Elections Division apart, I've articulated. This is in the absence of contribution limits or public financing, this is the only avenue we have in Oregon to find out who's financing campaigns.
You and I have actually, it was not you, it was Mr. Neal from your office, and I have discussed a letter that I do not have a copy of but is floating around this building somewhere from a person who handles a great number of CNEs, criticizing your security firewalls inside the CNE process to wit, if I, and again, I'm operating on tertiary information, but I presume, given the comments of Mr. Neal, that you all have seen this letter, indicating that there was the possibility that C&E information could be downloaded, manipulated in some way, and then not leave any tracks that it had been manipulated. And I think very much for the comfort level of Oregonians and certainly for the comfort level of those of us that are filing C&Es, to have some additional comment from your office about the integrity of that firewall system and the allegations made in this letter, it would be very comforting to put that issue to rest if you would be kind enough to provide us with a copy of the letter and some comment on it.
I'd be happy to do that, Madam Chair. I mean, just the short answer is we have made a decision not to spend a huge mountain of money to protect public records. I think the risk, there's no case that I'm aware of anybody attempting to do what's alleged in the letter. It's sort of beyond me what the purpose of breaking in to this system would be, and that at the cost of securing a system that transports public records that come to our office and go over the counter is a little lost on me. But I'm happy to provide a more detailed response.
I might just share anecdotally, it was not lost on people charged with filing accurate C&Es and in conversations that I had in this building, ergo my interest in putting it to rest once and for all about just what integrity exists in the ability to electronically manipulate any of those records.
I know we're not supposed to talk about POPs, but number 21 is a POP. This is $700,000, the original of general fund money. This will allow us to free up $18 million of federal money that's sitting in the federal treasury with Oregon's name on it. The Help America Vote Act gave the 50 states and 5 territories a long list of requirements and offered federal money. The choice that we have in Oregon is either we need $3 million of general fund money to comply with the Help America Vote Act and say no to the federal money, or we need $700,000 of general fund money as our match and say yes to the federal money.
Thank you very much. I'm also going to ask Monica to flag this one. I know that I sat in on some of the early Help America Vote Act committee meetings that you were having with county clerks, and I know from the meetings that I attended the depth of detail that you were pursuing with the clerks to assure the integrity of Oregon's voting system. I know you have made some effort to have machines available in this building. Regrettably, they were at times when lots of legislators, I don't think, could avail themselves of the opportunity. But I would very much appreciate, and I think the committee would also, a quick summary on sort of where we are in the Help America Vote initiative undertaken by your office. And I'm not asking for an exhaustive treatise, but just where we are and what the timeline looks like for the rollout of any of the other stuff. I think of particular interest is a centralized voter registration.
I think, let me just start the answer and then Patty certainly can cover it. But there are really three huge issues or mandates in the federal act, HAVA. One is to get rid of punch cards. We've done that. We're a punch card free zone now. Second is to create a centralized voter registration system. That's why we need the money to finish that, but we are on budget, on target, and basically would expect to have a centralized voter registration system up and running by the primary of 2006. That's minimum you need $3 million more dollars to get that done. And then the third thing that HAVA relates to is really dealing with making sure that the disabled can vote privately and independently. And that is a very expensive issue for states, most states that have polling places, because they have to install new systems in every polling place. We're working with the counties and the disability community to have specialized equipment, but it'll be installed in each county. So it really reduces the costs of that.
Madam Chair, if I can just add to that, on April 4th in the Galleria, we're going to be having a vendor fair of people who sell elections equipment that is accessible to people with disabilities. We need to have in place under the federal act by January 1, 2006, elections equipment that is fully accessible to people with disabilities. Optical scan ballots don't meet that test.
I guess what I'm struggling with is the characterization of allowing people to vote privately and independently, and the great accommodation being made for the disabled community in Oregon, given our unique, are we still unique as vote by mail? 100%.
So far. Okay. We're the only state that votes entirely by mail.
I guess the concern is that if the goal is to vote privately and independently, nobody's assuring that that happens in my house. Ma'am, why should I be any different from any other voter? And I'm just trying to reconcile what seems to me to be an anomaly between my ability to vote privately and independently and someone assuring that that occurs and someone assuring that a person with a disability can vote privately and independently.
Madam Chair, I can't speak specifically to your household situation, but you clearly have the ability both to understand a ballot and to mark a ballot. And if you choose to do that out in the back barnyard, away from whoever else is in your house, you have the ability to do that.
Mm-hmm.
There are many people with disabilities who do not have the ability to do that, number one. And number two, the way we currently deal with people with disabilities is we offer them assistance, and two people from a county elections office go out, generally a Democrat and a Republican, go out and visit with that person and interview them, saying, well, how do you want to vote, or how can we help you vote? So the way they vote is in front of two other people. I don't think you're subject to that kind of a situation. I mean, maybe you are, but
Senator Morris.
It's your choice if you are.
Mr. Secretary, I think of even greater concern, having participated intimately in an election when I was running, is the care and custody and the integrity of the process once the person has voted, between that vote and sealing and transporting that ballot to a drop-off. And I just find it really fraught with potential abuse for anybody to call up a voter and say, may I pick up your ballot?
Mm-hmm.
I think the integrity of the process has been seriously compromised by allowing that to happen, because you don't know what the motive is of the person that is picking up the ballot. Generally, I believe it to be honorable, but generally doesn't work in elections in preserving the integrity. And so I don't know what your response or thought might be about that, but I do have a very serious concern about the integrity of the process.
I think it's shared by lots of folks.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, one of the messages that we tried to get out and have tried to get out the last several elections is treat your ballot as you would your mortgage check or your rent check. And that, you know, frankly, it's more important, but if you would hand your mortgage check to a stranger on the assurance that they're going to get it to your mortgage company, or your rent check will get your rent check to your landlord, you know, go ahead and treat your ballot that way. But we have a very strong message out of our office And I think that's, and we have tried to portray that in a manner that most people can understand and deal with. And I think, I mean, I would hesitate to say we've been fabulously successful, but that has been our message, and I think will continue to be our message.
Well, just as a follow-up, and I appreciate that. However, I think that there certainly is justification for a statute that would prohibit an independent person from out of the blue calling up and saying, "Can I pick up your ballot?" And it would add reinforcement, I think, to the integrity of the process. That, you know, it could be at the direction of the voter to have someone help them at their election. But as you well know, and you know, everybody looks at those lists of who have voted now and who haven't, and they're calling. And they're saying, "Can we pick up your ballot?"
Absolutely.
And it's whether it's an R or a D or whatever, that really is immaterial. And I think it's a serious breach of this process.
I would say, Senator, that the one concern I would have is this needs to be carefully crafted so that, I mean, let's give you one personal example. I have an elderly neighbor who knows I'm in the elections business and has vision issues, and she calls me. And I go over to her house and help her fill out her ballot, and she asked me to take it in. Now, I don't think that should be illegal. And I would hope that whatever solution comes from you allows that sort of activity to take place. And I think that your suggestion of a voter-generated request rather than an outside request to the voter may be exactly that solution.
A subset, Senator Morris, if you'll let me piggyback on your concern, I think certainly a subset is voter registration. I think that all of us are interested in having a wide participation in elections and have done what we can to help encourage people to register to vote. But I think some news stories of this last election cycle with people collecting voter registrations, the unwary citizen placing their voter registration card in someone's hands and then having all of a particular political party culled out and thrown away. Hopefully, you all will be engaged in some public education activities around those sorts of issues, too, because while I certainly elevate the ballot, the completed ballot to a higher standard than the registration, I think there are lots of problems with the registration of voters right now.
Well, we have put in there is a piece of legislation that's been introduced that actually came up after our deadline for introduction passed. So there is a piece of legislation that's been introduced that basically prohibits you from being, right now we have a law that's been adopted by the voters that says you can't be paid by the signature for circulating initiative petitions, you can only be paid for your time. Okay? That's what I call the bounty hunter law. And we're trying to, the bill is seeking to extend the bounty hunter law to voter registration and nominating petitions as well as initiative petitions. And so that would basically, there would be no, you would be creating no incentive. You couldn't pay people for their registration of a specific party only. You'd have to pay someone so much an hour for collecting voter registrations.
Well, unless I hear, given the lateness of the hour, unless I hear objection from the committee, I think we'd like to engage in a little bit deeper discussion about your prioritization of those kinds of activities that assure integrity throughout our voting system as we move through this presentation or into the phase two part of it. Senator Morse.
Patty, I'm not going to be here tomorrow, and you're going to sing "When Irish Eyes Are Smiling" or something.
I was planning on Danny Boy, but
Danny Boy is fine. I can't be as long as I'm be before. But we had an interesting partial discussion on some of the performance outcomes, which I hope carry over. I will probably miss that. Maybe in phase two, I'll be looking at that.
We'll save some of the good stuff for phase two.
Because that was a really, really interesting discussion on differences of opinion of what is performance. We added some things to them and took some things away. So.
Well, with the expectation of hearing Mr. McGuire's stirring rendition of Danny Boy tomorrow, unless there are questions or comments from the committee, I am going to close the public hearing on how...